And on that note.
And on that note, that's it. That's the one.
Hello and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast full of friendship, feelings, and snark. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney.
And today we are joined by Chelsea.
Hi everybody, I'm Chelsea. You can find me mostly online on Twitter at An Outlaw Life. I'm defunct YouTuber, defunct podcaster, barely surviving human being. So Twitter is where to find me.
And Chelsea is back with us again today to talk about the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy. We were going to do this episode originally like a year ago. If you are part of our Discord, this was our monthly book club pick sometime back in 2020. But here we are, finally talking about this trilogy. And because it is a whole trilogy and there is so much to cover, we are going to do this. I now have to do the plot synopsis, and we are going to do this kind of as a throwback to the MCU episodes where there's a time limit. My thing is actually was already at a minute 30. So I'm going to give myself a minute 30 instead of 60 for each of the three books. Okay. I did not prepare to do it this way. So I apologize to all of the characters I leave out. Here we go. So Daughter of Smoke and Bone, the first book, is about a 17-year-old girl named Karu, who's an art student in Prague, and she can speak all these languages, and she has all these tattoos, including these like Hamsa tattoos on her hands, and everybody, including her best friend, who's also an art student named Zuzana, is like, this girl's fucking weird. And she has this like notebook where she draws these adventures of Chimera, they're made up of like creatures that are made up of a lot of different animal features. And the plot twist is that the stuff in her notebook is actually true, because Karu was raised by these Chimera, Brimstone, Issa, Twiga, and Yasri, and she can get to them through portals that are all over the world, but they always go to the same place on the other side where the Chimera live. Brimstone sends her on all of these missions to find teeth. teeth. And she's going on these errands to collect teeth. And then she notices that there's like burnt in handprints on a lot of the doors. And then one day the handprints, all of the doors blow up. The doors are on fire. She got a note from Brimstone from his bird, who's also now dead on fire. And she got a wishbone. And also she met an angel who she falls in kind of insta love with. But then he sees her wishbone and he's like, oh my God, I know who you are. And then they break the wishbone and they realize that she was actually a chimera and they were in love. And then he murdered all of her people. The end. That was exactly Tom.
Like, I know we just read all three of these books, but I'm sitting here listening and being like, that book sounds batshit. What is that?
Correct.
I feel like that was all the truly essential details.
Yeah, you hit it.
So, okay, the second book is Days of Blood and Starlight, and here I go. Oh, I forgot what even happens in this one. So Days of Blood and Starlight. Karu manages to get back into the Chimera world. She's like, fuck you, Akiva. But she found this fallen angel who gets her into the other world through like a portal in the sky. And she finds some remaining Chimera who didn't actually die. And she takes up Brimstone's job of being the resurrectionist. Oh, that's what I didn't say. She needed the teeth for Brimstone so that that was his thing. That's what he used them for, was to resurrect people. And now Karu does that because she's the only one who knows how. And also as sort of like a to repent, because it's her fault that Akiva, she blames herself. She blames herself for Akiva doing a genocide on her people. So she is doing that. And Akiva now feels really sad and guilty about the genocide that he did. And that's like sort of the main thing, is like Karu trying to resurrect people and resurrect Chimera, but the Chimera all hate her. And at the end of the book, Zuzana and her boyfriend find their way out to Karu because they're hanging out in Morocco because they can't be in the other world. And then the main the wolf who's in charge of the Chimera tries to rape Karu, and then she murders him, and then another Chimera shows up and is like, listen, you can put my soul in his body. And Akiva and his siblings go to murder the Emperor of the Angels, and that's time. So, okay. The only, I think, essential thing that I left out of that is that their sibling, their Akiva's brother Hazael, dies when they try to murder the Emperor, and then he and his sister flee back to Earth to try to have Karu like resurrect him, but it's too late. He's like dead. But they're
very sad.
It's very sad. I didn't even talk to you at all about Hazael and Laraz, but they're characters, and we'll talk about them later. But that detail is important because they end up back in Earth. They're in Morocco is sort of the key thing. They're in Morocco, and they know shit about what's going on in the other world. So the final book, Dreams of Gods and Monsters. We're introduced to yet another character who on Earth. She's a Eliza Jones. She's a researcher in DC. She grew up in a cult, and she like has these terrifying nightmares. And that's really all you need to know about her for now. Akiva and Laraz tell the Chimera, they're like, listen, the angels are actually coming to Earth because they realize that Earth weapons are cool, and that people on Earth will worship them and will give them things. So the angels are coming. And then the Akiva and his siblings are part of this like very powerful but not at all respected unit of the army. They're all bastards. And so they decide that the Chimera and the bastards are going to form an alliance against the Dominion, which is the army that's coming to Earth to get a bunch of weapons. So then they have this sort of unlikely alliance, they're sort of like casual, unhappy friends, and they are able to go hide out in some caves in the other world, and they... then there's this whole other group of people who do magic that Akiva is really from, and the other magic people help them win their war against the Dominion. And I don't even, there's so much I can't do it. That's okay. Well, that's time. What is important that needs to happen that I haven't said? So Eliza Jones is it turns out her cult was legit, and she's actually the descendant of a fallen angel. I don't know if I even mentioned the fallen angel in the first book, but there was a fallen angel, and he's like the reason that the Dominion know about Earth weapons. And so she's like the bridge to... There's like a whole other like story that's being introduced in the final book. Karu and Akiva, like their story, more or less, we get to the end of the story that the first two books told, in that the war is over and now angels and Chimera are gonna like live in peace or whatever. But Karu has to like keep resurrecting them. And Akiva, unfortunately, has to like join the other super magical angels who are called stellions, because he's like half stellion, and he turns out he's a super powerful stellion, and so he has to go with them, because the thing with the fallen is that the fallen opened a bunch of portals like 1,000 years ago and let these like crazy monsters in, and the stellions have to do magic to keep the monsters out, and now Akiva is like, he has to go help them do that magic to keep the monsters out. And that's like a whole other thread that is separate from what we were doing for the first two books. I think that's like as much as we need to get through. Eretz is the world that the Chimera and the angels live in. The other thing is that the angels are not actually from Eretz, and the thing that we learn with the fallen is that like the angels are actually the ones who invaded Eretz, and so like them enslaving the Chimera is like, it's there's a whole added colonizer thing to that, because it's not even their home world, but they enslaved the Chimera. Mm-hmm. And the Chimera revolted. And then, all the things in the three books happened. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm going to leave it. That's what we get for a synopsis. It's a lot, okay? It's a fucking lot.
It's a trilogy to begin with. And usually we're doing like a media per episode. But also there's just a lot that happens across the three books. But yeah. We will start where we always start. And so I'm going to ask you, did you like it? But also, I believe that this was a reread for all three of us. So tell me a little bit about when you first discovered it, what you first thought when you read it, and then answer the question, did you like it for like your now read, your now self?
Yes, I love this book. I have read this book the umpteenth number of times. There is something about this whole trilogy that I find like weirdly addicting. I first read it, I want to say it was like 2012-ish. It was shortly after it had come out and I had started working as a young adult librarian. And so like purchasing stuff for the department. And this, I came across this like in the process of that. And I read the first one and I just was like so sucked in by the languaging and like the frame tale, like fairy tale within a story that the first novel like sets up and how that operates, that I was hooked from the very beginning. So I read books 2 and 3. I've read A Night of Cake and Puppets, which is the short story about Mick and Zuzana. And so like I get something a little different each time that I read it. So reading it this time, coming fresh off of 2020, I was very much tapped into this whole like the cycle of suffering and the propagation of violence against other groups and like how bigotry works and operates, just, you know, for no reason. So that part of kind of like the whole overarching thing is really interesting to me. And I think stuck out the most on this time around.
I also really love this trilogy. It's like the reason that we picked it as our book club book. It was something that we were both down to reread. And this reread did not disappoint. I feel like I came to the trilogy pretty late and I have honestly no idea how or why. I put it on hold at the library and then it appeared and I read the first one in a day and a half and just kind of immediately charged ahead to read the others back in 2018. And this is the first time that I'm rereading it, but I suspect that this will kind of be added to my annual-ish reread rotation because I really, really love this series.
Yeah, I also love it. As Nicole said, it is one of the things that we like joint love. So at some point when we started thinking about the podcast in general, you know, we really shifted to this like leaning more towards picking things that we strongly suspected we would enjoy or at least putting more of that into our rotation. So this was one of the things that was like, you love it and I love it. We need to talk about it. It is an older trilogy, so I don't know. We just picked it solely based on that. But I read it for the first time, the first book, at the end of 2012. It was like one of the last things I read. And if you know anything about like 2012 and YA, it was like the height of like the YA dystopian craze, like a lot of YA fantasy that wasn't necessarily very good. And I personally read a ton of YA in that year that that was the year I read The Selection.
We had hit third tier level of Hunger Game ripoffs. Like we had done Hunger Games and Divergent, and now we were down to like all the rest of what came after that.
Correct. Truly correct. Scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So at the very end of 2012, like probably one of the last books I read was this one, and I had this thing where I was like, I think this was amazing. Like it was like a really weird like sense of like I'm not 100% sure, but I think it is amazing. And so I've now reread it 3 other times, that one book, and can confirm that I do really love this. And I did finish a trilogy back in 2015, but this is my second time reading the second and third books. So I haven't reread those quite as much, but yeah, I love them and they did hold up for me in a lot of new, interesting ways. So I'm excited to talk about all of that. I think where we will start, and we can't talk about every single character, just like we can't talk about every single plot point, but we'll start with the main characters, starting right at the top with everybody's favorite blue-haired protagonist, Karou. What do you guys think about Karou?
Like, there are times reading this book, and I've probably legit read this whole trilogy like 10 times, and there's still some times when I'm reading the first one, and I'm like, could I dye my hair blue? Like, could I pull that off? Like, is that a thing that I have, like, the energy to maintain? Could I do that? Because they talk about it all the time, and it's always, like, her sapphire hair and, like, her azure hair. And she, like, it waves in the wind. I'm like, I know blue hair is a bitch to maintain, and hers is magical. But, like, could I do that?
I mean, not to, like, immediately derail the conversation, but there are so many things like in this book that are that way. Like Karu's blue hair, I'm like, yeah, could I do that? Also like Prague, can I go there? But also, do I want to be like a puppeteer like Susanna? Because yes, I do. But there are so many like vivid details that like I just want them all for me. So yes, you are not the only one who wants to dye her hair blue immediately after reading this.
My like big quarantine hobby has been sewing. So as sort of an addendum to this, like plus one, and I briefly had the thought, like, do I want to try to do a Karu cosplay? Like, is that a thing I want to do? But like, there's actually not that much to do. She just wears like grimy, ripped up, like dirty clothes. So I decided to not pursue that, but it was an idea that crossed my mind.
There is just, and I don't know if it's, yeah, I don't know if it was that first impression coming off of that whole like wave of quote, like capital strong girls in that like dystopian YA deluge when this book first came out. And so like the stark contrast of that to both Karu and Susanna just like imprinted on me super hard. Mm-hmm. But there is just something like from the first time that you see Karu interacting with literally anybody in her life that you're just like, I want to be that girl's friend. Like that is a person who I would enjoy being friends with in real life.
The whole thing too, where in her human life, part of how she manages to live the double life that she's living is by adopting this persona where she is constantly telling the truth, but she's doing it with sort of a wink and a smile. And so it turns into this thing that people think is a like a quirky affectation that she puts on. I find everything about the way that this character is set up to be so charming. And I also love, in order to move a story along, right, your protagonist has to make a lot of, like, has to make some bad choices, you know?
Right.
And I feel for her so strongly when she is making all of her bad choices. Like, in the first book, all of her petulance where Brimstone is concerned makes sense. Like, she's 17 years old and she has to go do all this shit, but nobody tells her anything. And, like, truly as a, you know, like kid, what is like not being told anything mm-hmm. really high up there on the list of like the great injustices.
And especially if you're gonna ask me to do things for you, yes, and you're not gonna right. tell me why,
you're not even gonna, it's because I said so, me, how fucking dare you.
You a monster are going to with no context to what you even are, like absolutely not.
And then later in the also to the first book, when Akiva is facing off against Laraz and Hazael, when they come and find him, and he's like, just fucking stand behind me and shut up. And she instead spends a wish to learn Seraphic and then turns around and is like, you talking about me? And I just, it's, I love it. I love her. Yes. I love her so much. And going beyond just the first book, the one of the things that stood out to me that I don't think I really noticed on first read, but that I really kept like clocking on this read, is all of the ways that they talk about her struggles to integrate this idea, like being two people, mm-hmm. like that she, you know, that she fundamentally lived this whole life as Karu, and like that is who she is now. She does not ask to be called Madrigal. Like that's her name is Karu now. She is Karu, and like the way in which Madrigal has been reintegrated into her sense of self, and watching her kind of grapple with that was also very, very interesting to me.
I also love her. I think that what Chelsea said is like dead on to my experience of being in the thick of that 2012 like onslaught of YA protagonists. Like if you check out my review of this from 2012, like the first couple paragraphs is just me amazed that we are introduced to this character by her standing up to her like crappy ex-boyfriend, and me being like, can you imagine? We see this in YA. So apparently that was like so surprising to me in that time of this genre or this category that I had to make a note of it. But I think that the book introduces her so well because you immediately get a sense of who she is, her charm, her strength, and you know, her you know, the pull or the attraction, her talents mm-hmm. and all of that. Mm-hmm. So you're immediately invested in her. I think that this read, I had so much more, I don't know, my heart went out to her more. I remember being really frustrated with her, especially in the middle book. And because of that middle book, she just spends a lot in stasis and sort of like not clearly seeing things because of a lot of the guilt that she's experiencing. And I was so frustrated with her my first read, and I was just like, oh my gosh, it's not your fault, like move on. But this time around, I don't know, it just read differently. I think I understood her struggles a lot more and a lot of her tragedy. And we picked this back in 2020, and I literally spent this weekend reading it, so very last minute, very on brand. But also, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, I see why I was putting it off, is because as much as I love these books, they are very sad in a lot of ways. And yeah. a lot of that tragedy just comes from Karu's entire heartbreak of a life. And even down to the things that make it so beautiful and like fully realized, like her friendships and her found family, are part of what make it so tragic. And all of those little things that are petulant that then turn around and act as this sort of like constant knife in the heart for her. You know, just, and the way that I can sit here and talk about all of this, because she is such a fully realized character.
Yes.
And there yes. are these moments that are just so imprinted in my memory. Her throwing her ex-boyfriend through the glass door. Like, I was waiting mm-hmm. for that moment because I was like, I know this happens in this book and I will never forget. And then this time it stood out too when she's telling Akiva about how the wolf attacked her, and like right after she Ziri came along and kind of like helped her and provided a solution. And Akiva has this moment of like anger, and he's like, I should have been there to protect you. And she goes, I protected myself in that moment. It was afterward that I needed help, and I got it. And I don't know why that like moment of like, oh, my precious child, like I just love her so much. So that is like now another scene that is like forever burned in my brain. And there's so many of those moments because this character is just so spectacular.
Okay, this is not important, but you mentioning it being last minute, I realized I actually did do this reread last year. I just didn't get to the third book. So I did actually read the first two books last year. The third book I have now only read twice. That's probably why the third book was my great struggle.
Makes sense.
Well, and there's some. Well, I'm sure we'll get to it. There's some pacing issues with the third book that surprise me even now when I read them, because the first book is so, I think, perfectly paced mm-hmm. and compactly narrated. Like Marines was saying, like we get that fully fleshed, like the person that Karu is, the world in which she lives, the people with which she spends her time, and how she spends it, and it all comes across so vividly and so really kind of like compactly. And it's just something that I think is really amazing about that first book, that like I don't dislike the books any less, but that compactness gets a little wobbly by the third book.
Yes.
To be nice about it.
So we love Karu. Moving on from there, the next major character and a big piece of this whole star-crossed lovers deal that the books have going on is, in fact, Akiva, who is her angel counterpart that she falls in love with. How do you guys feel about Akiva?
He's fine.
Yes. Okay, good.
Look, I love Akiva. The first time I read it, I was much more in love with Akiva than I am now. I just like, to me, it's like Karu is just so like, her light is so bright that everything around her just pales in comparison. So I'm like, Akiva, yes, it's fine. He's great. There's a lot of, I think, really interesting conversations that like the character of Akiva starts and that his story kind of like brings to the front. But like, he's hot. He's tortured. He's got daddy issues. He's got a mysterious past. Like, he's checking a lot of YA hero boxes for me. And like, also he has wings. So he's fine. Like, he's great. He's fine.
I mean, yeah, I love Akiva. I don't know. Like, I don't, I feel like I don't have like a ton to say in his defense, but also I feel like I should because of the lukewarm reaction that you guys are giving him. But also, I don't know, something that, again, I did not really think that much about on first read, or at least I don't recall thinking about it that much, but that, you know, sat with me a little bit differently this time, and I mentioned it in my quick plot synopsis, is like the degree to which, you know, Akiva tries to commit a genocide, basically, and like how all of that sits. And I, like, when that starts out, I was much more anxious about it. And I don't know if it's that I like braced myself and then it ended up being, it didn't come around to being quite the level of like problem that I was fearing that it would be. Because I think like there are so many other things that are going on there. And like the story is grappling with it. Like it's not like they treat it as this thing that like he does. And then later they're like, oh, okay, but it's fine now. Like the story deals with it, and it's also not just him. Like he is part of a larger machine, and that's also part of how the story is deal. Like that's part of what the story is talking about, is the ways in which like it's not, this isn't Loki kind of being our obvious example that we've talked about on the podcast, our big sort of frustration. It's not that this is not a like Loki situation, I guess is really where I'm going with that. But yeah, I don't know. I agree that Karu is the best one. Like Karu is better than Akiva, hands down, no argument here. But I enjoy the way that this character functions. I also, like, narratively, one of the things that I loved the most about the first book is the ways in which the first book introduced some tropes that I hate, like the insta-love between Karu and Akiva, and then, like, it flips it in this way that's like, heh, I got you! Like, and I'm like, you're
there's
right.
Some real soulmate, soul bond trope stuff happening here.
But, like, in a way that it was satisfying. Like, that was a satisfying payoff, and it wasn't just, like, it wasn't this completely randomly faded sort of thing. Like, there, it made sense, their sort of original, like, love, like, how they found each other, then made it make sense that they were once again in each other's orbit, you know, in Karu's new, like, whatever, as Karu. Like, all of it made perfect sense, and it was a genuinely sort of satisfying explanation for the insta-love.
Yeah. And I've always thought about that in the context of the first book, how the first book gives you this insta-love and then sort of like flips it. So it's like, but it's not, because, you know, they've been here before. But the thing that I appreciated so much more on this read was realizing how the rest of the series then continues to flip that. Because in the first book, you get this like thing of, okay, they fall in love instantly. But then you watch them like find each other again incredibly slowly over the next two books. And so it is this thing where even if you felt that moment of like it was maybe unearned, or we got to really see them falling in love the first time in flashback and not in the immediacy of the plot that we're currently reading, or the timeline we're currently reading, then you get to watch them through the next two books like really struggle to think about what it means, what they have experienced, what they need to do in the future, the way that they have let each other down, and sort of the past tragedies and hurts or whatnot. So it then becomes just like a really regularly, maybe even slow paced sort of romance of seeing them find each other, you know, seeing them find each other once again. So I really appreciated that. I was like, wait, we do get to see them like falling in love. I love this.
And that's also part of the like Karu trying to sort of integrate her Madrigal self. Like, so Karu is sort of having that experience in terms of navigating her, you know, her new whatever, falling back into love with Akiva / Madrigal falling back into love, Karu sort of like falling in love for real, like that dynamic. And then we also see it a little bit from Akiva's side too, in terms of him being like, oh, but I actually don't, like, I don't know Karu. Like, I was drawn to her because Madrigal was in there, but I don't really know her. And so, yeah, having those, I don't know, identity bits kind of sprinkled throughout as well was also something that I really enjoyed about their story.
Yeah, I think you can see Akiva wrestling a little bit with almost a similar kind of thing of like, obviously he is not in a different like corporeal form, but he is very much so a different person when he meets Karu than the person he was when he was with Madrigal. And he has the extra almost like burden of like, he didn't get to forget. He is, as much as that presents issues for Karu, Akiva has known all of these things and remembers how all of this happened and was there for all of the deleted scenes that Karu just does not have. And so there is a, like, he has to then slot that too into his refiguring out of like, okay, she is this new person. I am now different. I know all these things that I did that she wasn't there for, but that happened to her community. And like, there's several puzzle pieces that I like that they get that time in the second and third book to really kind of pull out the tangles and see how everything slots together really nicely.
To be clear, I love Akiva too. Like, I love him primarily because Karu loves him. Yes. Mm-hmm. And like, I want only happiness and joy for Karu. I think that really the issue here is that Karu is, you know, sort of by definition, this bright, bubbly, charming character. And Akiva is the one who's like, his whole thing is like being able to put up a wall and being a little bit more emotionless and expressionless. So mm-hmm. I think naturally when you have that play of characters, it's easier just to go more towards the more expressive and charming one, which Karu is. So a lot of times it was just like, you know, Akiva wasn't feeling anything. And I was like, great. Thanks, Akiva. Thanks for playing along. You know? But I do, my heart goes out to him. I think he has a very interesting story arc and character arc as well. And again, Karu loves him, so I'm in.
I think to that point, he suffers a little bit for the fact that their first story only happens very briefly and in flashback. Because mm-hmm. like, we kind of get the vibe that he was that, you know, like he was more that way back then too, you know, like when he comes and finds her at the whatever, at the big festival thing, you know, they have this moment where he's like, I have not killed anyone since the last time we met. And she's like, oh, cause I have, like, oops.
Yeah, I didn't know we were doing that, so I did. Yeah. I didn't know it was a thing.
Oopsie.
And at that moment, not only that, but like at that moment too, she is, you know, not expecting to have met him, whatever, like, but she's going into that night with the sense of like, I guess I don't really want to marry the wolf, but like, seems like this is what I'm gonna do, and I'm just sort of like following the path that's been laid out for me, and I kind of don't like, I'm not really actively avoiding making any of her own choices, and just sort of like rolling with it. And it's, yeah, I don't know, I like my sense of who they were then, the vibe would be very different in terms of how you think about like the two of them. But unfortunately for Akiva, that is a very small section of the story. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. We've only talked about two characters.
It's fine, guys. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. It's a 3-hour podcast. It's fine. It'll be fine.
So one of the things that I love about these books is also Karu's just like extended relationships. And for our badass queen, you know, leading the revolution, she gets to have such beautiful and strong friendships. So Susanna and Mick, briefly, how do we feel about them?
I'll be brief because I don't have words. Like, it is entirely possible that I love Susanna and Mick more than I love Karu and Akiva, just because there is like the way that Mick loves Susanna and Susanna's mm-hmm. energy of just always being like, you know what? Cool. Like, let's roll with it. We got flying monsters. We got intergalactic war. We got puppets. Like, let's do it. We're going to figure it out and roll with it. So, like, I love that whole, like, thing between them of he's going to earn her love with, like, fairy tale tasks. And that's something mm-hmm. that they draw out. And it's just so cute. And I just, apparently I do have a lot of words, but I love them a lot.
I generally agree. I mean, I'm not going to go quite so far as to say that I love him more than Karu overall. However, I do. I really, really love Susanna. I don't really have super strong feelings about Mick. I don't know. I guess it's in kind of the same way that you guys were describing your sentiments towards Akiva. Mm-hmm. I love that Mick loves Susanna and that Susanna loves Mick. And that's kind of the extent of my feelings about Mick. But I love Susanna and I love their friendship. And that's another thing that is like so great about this trilogy, is that I feel like it treats Karu and Susanna's friendship well. Like it is given appropriate, you know, screen to whatever time on the page. Like, it's given appropriate time in the story, and like, it addresses the ways in which, you know, Karu's life makes it hard for her to be a great friend and whatnot. And like, Susanna's also a teenager, and so sometimes she can be a little bit like frustrated and not an insufficiently understanding of what Karu is going through, and all of that is given sort of space and time. But at the end of the day, they both just love each other and care about each other so much that Karu and Susanna's friendship is wonderful and amazing, and one of many things that is great about this trilogy.
Yeah, and for a trilogy that has really heavy themes and dark moments, and you know, genocide, and just a ton of like darker subjects, it's all about war and like generations long war. So many bright and funny moments come from these two characters and their dialogue. I love the dialogue in this so freaking much. Mm-hmm. And that is mostly thanks to Susanna and Mick. And yes, love their friendship. In defense of Mick, I think that he jumps into this. You know, Zuzana is like sort of already there with Karu as her best friend. So it makes sense the way she's kind of like a dog with a bone. Like, no, that's my best friend. I'm going to go to the desert and track her down and all that. Mm-hmm. But Mick is just kind of like, okay, like swept up in this because he starts falling in love with her. Mm-hmm. But you see throughout that he has these moments where he is like checking up on Karu and he's like, no, but how are you? And like, you know, it extends to include her because, you know, of the way that he loves Zuzana. Like, I don't know. He was just so tender and careful and just such a good piece of that whole puzzle. And again, one of my favorite scenes in the second book is where they just end up in the cafeteria wooing all the chimera. Because they're that amazing. So I love these characters.
Zuzana's nickname becomes Neek Neek, which is this like chimera, like little scorpion shrew kind of thing. And just like, so like, because I have very chipper, love you guys, but very short friends, and they all possess this very similar kind of like fiercely protective, like, do not step with me and do not fuck with the people that I love, like kind of vibe. And so like, I love that Zuzana very much has that, but is also like, and I want chocolate cake and a bubble bath. And like, I think because she's the lighter moments and her and Mick are almost constantly the comic relief and lightning agent, that just makes their, that makes their moments stand out to me in the book. Because like we said, so much of this book is questioning genocide and war and forgiveness and reparations and all of those kinds of bigger things. So
okay, listen, I did not at any point while reading it think like, oh, Zuzana and Mari are so similar, but that the list of things you specifically chose to single out about my short best friend,
I was just sitting here thinking about the inches that Nicole has on me. But like, our running joke in our friendship is like that I will be the one that is 100% going to be like, what did you just say? Say it to my face. Like,
amazing. Another thing that is great about that cafeteria scene, in addition to being like really wonderful sort of comic moment in a very heavy story, is how that kind of ties back to Karu as well. Like her moment of realization that because she was so lost in her own grief and all of those feelings, because, you know, she all at once had all of this thrust upon her after not knowing for 17 years and then suddenly getting Madrigal's life and what Akiva did and, you know, and all of that all at once. It's very, very heavy and it's this thing that she's wrestling with. But then the cafeteria scene is this moment where she's like, oh, but also I never tried. Like I made no effort to be friends with anybody. Like, yes, the wolf was like making it a lot worse, but this moment of realization that in her, like in her depression, there are a lot of things about the series that I feel like have kind of big like mental health ties. Even, you know, yeah. I've never lived through my multi-generational war like this, but there are things like that though that click, where it's just like, oh, because I've been like so bogged down in like my own shit that some of the problems that I'm having interpersonally are kind of extensions of that, and in fact not necessarily reflections of what other people are thinking of me.
Yeah, I also, that scene has one of my favorites in the book, and it's when Mick starts to play his violin and one of the chimera starts to cry, because the chimera don't have music like that. They have war drums and things, but they don't have like Brahms concertos. So Mick starts to play his violin. It's just one of those, like, I get really into like opining about the beauty of art, especially in environments where that is not necessarily something that's frequently come by. So when Karu and the book take a moment to like notice that and notice music happening in a place that is bereft of music and like what that means to the people around, I just was like, this little chef's kiss, little scene in that moment.
Another big thing apart from Karu's friendships is, especially I would say in the first book, found family. Karu feels a lot like she's out on her own because before she knows who she is. And then even when she gains her memories again, she's orphaned at an early age and she doesn't really have a lot of her same kind of people. Just one other person survives of the Kirin. So in a lot of ways, she's always fighting against this feeling of being alone. But there are constant and frequent memories about her found family and Brimstone, who's taken her in and not only trained her to do like this work, but also kind of, you know, accepted her as a daughter. So do we have any thoughts about Brimstone and the rest of the Chimera that raise Karoo?
I mean, I love them.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the answer to all of them.
Like, of course, like, Brimstone is very much so this like, archetypical, it's kind of like a Yoda meets, like, Ben Kenobi meets, like, adoptive stepfather meets, like, resurrectionist and warmonger. Like, there's that whole side of him that is still very much, like, he's resurrecting bodies for this eternal war against the angels, but also almost every quote that I've written down from this book is something that Brimstone has said. Mm-hmm. And I listen to the audiobooks a lot. And Kristen Varna, who narrates them, her Brimstone voice is just, I just really, really enjoy it. So I think that adds something to the layers of it. But I also like that in a very limited amount of scenes, you kind of get the scope of the relationships between, like, Brimstone and Yasri and Twiga and, like, how their relationships and how their interconnectedness around Karoo and then in the Chimera world, like, is brought forward into the shop where Karoo spends, like, most of her time. Because essentially she kind of, like, is raised in this almost, like, antechamber. It's like a doctor's waiting office almost kind of thing where she is raised. And then there's also in that place a portal to the Chimera world. So it's very, like, the layers there, both literally and figuratively, of, like, Brimstone standing in between her and the knowledge, but also facilitating what she does know and being the person who has saved her. I just think puts a lot of complex levels to their relationship, so that in the first book, when he disappears, it's very reeling and, like, disorienting, very much so like it is for Karoo.
I also love most of his lines, for sure. The most of the cries that I cried on this reread were Brimstone related. The whole bit at the end of the first book where he goes to Madrigal and, you know, it's just like, why would I be ashamed of you? Like, what, you know, what did you do? Mm-hmm. But fall in love and like that whole bit, like, truly lost it. just sat on my couch and sobbed. I don't like the voice that she does for Brimstone. It makes
really
me really uncomfortable. There is something about it that feels like, I don't know, like, what she's drawing on to get to that voice. It makes me uncomfortable, as a choice. So setting aside that, that piece of it, I very much love Brimstone. I love the whole idea of naming, you know, new Madrigal Hope, and his appreciation for what Madrigal and Akiva wanted and the ways in which he views his own work versus how other people look at him and his work. I think that's also something that is really, really interesting, and it's almost like a background thing, but like, you know, to the Chimera, he is this really important figure in, like, the war machine, and he's like a vital war figure. And obviously this is also very much the case for the angels. Once Akiva explains to them what's going on, you know, like, murdering the resurrectionist, very important because he's like a big sort of war figure. But like, his actual take on, like, his sense of what he was doing is like, I am just buying us time. Like, yeah. Nothing about this to me seems good. Like, I'm not doing this because I think that this is like a great idea, or because I think that this is something that we should want for ourselves or our children. I am just doing what I can to buy us time until we can do something else. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, I love him and I adore him. I love him. That's it.
I think it's so interesting what a huge presence he is in the whole trilogy, considering how very little time we spend with him, truly. Mm-hmm. And he pops up in, like, you know, flashbacks and things like that. But considering, you know, it's relatively small screen time for Brimstone, but it is just such a huge presence. And because he's so important to Karoo, and, you know, she keeps thinking about him in that context of, like, having raised her now that she was Karoo, but also what he did for her when she was Madrigal. And then when she takes on the role of resurrectionist, it becomes like she almost sees him in a different light. So we get to see him in a different light as well. And then, you know, in the not oddest, but like even in these small moments where she's thinking, you know, like it's nothing like a body Brimstone would make, and his were so artistic and beautiful. So she keeps remembering mm-hmm. him in ways that keeps him at the forefront of the reader's mind.
Mm-hmm. Which is also just a huge piece of a grief story, you know, the degree Correct. To which this person that she's lost. Yeah.
Yes, it just keeps, like, in daily life, how that hits you, right? Like, the grief keeps coming up in moments that are tied to memories. And so, also, like, in the middle of, like, pandemic, this is so, like, offshoot niche, I don't know. So, thinking about the, like, people in our lives who are making bad decisions in the middle of pandemic, like, yeah. you know, parents making bad decisions, but also not wanting to fight with them because, mm-hmm. you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic and God forbid the last words you ever tell to somebody are said in anger or anything mm-hmm. like that. So that is definitely something that I've thought about a lot during this time.
Yes.
So then to have that part of Karu's like grief story is the way she left things with Brimstone and how many unanswered questions she had about who she was and what he thought of her or what. Not just constant tragedy throughout the whole reading experience. Every time I thought about it, it was like new tears.
Yeah. I also love the role that he plays in this larger story about the multi-generational war too, because we see the way that, you know, being at war and being alive for hundreds of years affects some of the other characters. And it only comes up like once or twice, though, this idea of like what it does to the Chimera to just have to keep coming back to like to die again and again mm-hmm. and like it comes up in the context of Brimstone mentions it, and then the shitty sister who sells her out, I forget her name, but sort of alludes to it, but mm-hmm. the fact that he has been alive for hundreds of years and the effect that it has had on him is mostly to make him tired, but mm-hmm. not like the fact that it hasn't hardened him in mm-hmm. quite the way that it has other characters. And I think that also feeds into the way that other characters kind of see him and yes. in that role too, mm-hmm. you know, is how they have been hardened and jaded by this multi-generational war that they've been living through. Whereas his sort of takeaway is that the only reason that his work has value is if he can believe that they get that there's a future that is not this.
I think it's really interesting because you can see in him, and we get it a little bit too in the Warlord, like we never really speak directly with the Warlord of the Chimera, whose father to Thiago. Like Thiago is a character we know really well, but like him and Brimstone, like you were saying, Nicole, both kind of share that like this war is like we fought this war to gain a certain like goal, and we are not here to just continue to do this for eternity for mm-hmm. the sake of doing it for eternity. And I think that there is a difference in a kind of benign and beleaguered like acceptance versus an almost bloodthirsty kind of enjoyment of pursual that we see in mm-hmm. like Thiago, and just the kind of energy that then brings to the renewing of the war. And we get into it in the second book, those questions of like, if you're doing the thing that the enemy is doing, how are you different than the enemy? And that I think is a spiral of like something that Brimstone and the Warmonger didn't do. And so it gets into this like the motivations and the expressions of those motivations in those different generations can have such a impact on the continuation of those legacies of violence. And I think that is what I love most about Akiva and all of the and Karum. Like, I'm always here for the first voice to speak up against the system of violence and say, like, this isn't how this should be going. Like, there's a different alternative. Or like, if we think hard enough, we have to be able to come up with a different alternative. So for Brimstone to see that and then seed that in this next generation that he never got to see come up and continue that, I think is also a sad part of the story.
But it's also very much part of it that you have all of these people who are not like Brimstone and the Warlord, who, as you said, we don't get to spend a ton of time with, but like they had a dream of something better because they were the ones who started it. Like that was the whole thing, is that they rose up and like that was always sort of the dream from the beginning. But most of the other characters that we meet never knew anything else. Like their lives have been war. Like yeah. they've been at war always. And so even, I don't know, even the bloodthirstiest among them, there is not that it like justifies it or it excuses it. There is at least like context that explains it, that explains the reasons why for people to not be that way, to get like the, you know, Madrigal and Akiva, like for them to be that way, like that is rare, you know,
yeah.
to be able to see that actually it doesn't have to be this way when it's the only thing that you've ever known.
I think that part of what she does so well about the war commentary is balance these two things where she doesn't let us forget mm-hmm. that it is sort of like this cog in a machine sort of deal where there is all of this generational stuff that feeds into the conflict that they're experiencing, but she doesn't let them back down from like individual responsibility as mm-hmm. well. And in a story that talks a lot about souls are one of our favorite things to talk about on Snark Squad, thanks to Angel and Buffy. So there's a lot of like talk about souls and like, you know, just because Karu senses them and the way that she describes souls is part of my favorite like sort of descriptions in the books as well. But also, you know, you get the sense of what war does to individuals. And I think that that's really highlighted in Akiva and his brother and sister, Hazael Laraz, because the way that they react. So you have Hazael, who's like still this like cheery person who can laugh, who can find joy. And then Laraz is like, no, absolutely. Like she's hardened. She's more shut down. And she's so scared of like intimacy with other people because of the way that it makes her vulnerable and whatnot. So you get a lot of like commentary about what this like war machine does on the individual, but also like what it does on a people as a whole as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is ridiculous. We've only talked about characters. However, any other favorites that you want to shout out before we try and move on and talk about like not characters? Mine personally is Ziri. Love him so much.
That was probably
my biggest cry in the book is the scene where he's in Thiago's body and he dies in the assault and he didn't like appoint anyone to come and glean his soul, and it just like I almost can't even talk about it right now, like it's so sad. I love him because I love that we get to see him from this like young kind of like puppy dog in love with Karu in her old life, but now he's like this different person like they all are, but he still has that little kernel of the old him inside of him that Karu kind of brings out, and I love him. I love the shadows that live. So that's what they're called, right? The shadows that live. They're just the idea of these two sphinx like women assassins moving through shadows and causing death, like very bleak but also very cool. And so I just, as Chimera, I was like, I like them.
Okay, but also just like to make this, while we're talking about characters, be like thematic again, the thing about Ziri too though is that like he was, I mean he doesn't remember much of it, but he was born outside of Loramendi, you know. Mm-hmm. So like he did mm-hmm. he like and Madrigal too, right? Like that's also part of the things that Madrigal got old enough that she remembers, like she did have a relatively, you know, normal away from the war childhood with her people before becoming a refugee mm-hmm. and having to go to Loramendi. Ziri following Madrigal and like kind of being in love with her as a kid and watching her, and the way that that also kind of shapes him into also being somebody who grows up
mm-hmm.
and is more capable of like seeing the possibility of another way.
I also think Ziri is where we get into the conversation about like within the book, like the purity of bodies, like because a lot of his thing is like he has never been killed and resurrected, so he's at first like given an assignment to stay kind of out of harm's way so that he can continue to maintain his original body. And so it just gets in, and like other characters, there's issues of like whether you're resurrected with like human parts of your body or all animal parts of your body, and then like which human parts of your body are human. And so like it just gets into a really interesting like hierarchy and discussion of the actual like physical form, which I just think is an interesting concept to consider, especially as compared to something like the soul, which is the counterpoint to that in the book.
It's interesting too, as an extension of the conversation that gets started with Madrigal. Like that's, we're introduced to this idea of the purity of bodies because in an exceedingly gross way, obviously gross way, with Thiago wanting mm-hmm. her because she is pure and all of that, and like and that is presented in a way that I think is really easy to make connections to like our world.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can draw that parallel cleanly and easily. And so the fact that that conversation is continued in the second book with Ciri, I think is really, to your point, it is super interesting in terms of the way that it expands this conversation about like what even is a body.
As we've talked about all of this, like we have by extension been talking about Lainey Taylor's writing, but I think that one of the like make it or break it things for people and whether or not they will enjoy this is Lainey Taylor's writing style, because mm-hmm. it is very descriptive, and the longer you go on in the series, like the longer the books get and the more descriptive I feel like she becomes. Mm-hmm. But it is something that is just so, I love it so much, not only in this trilogy but in her other books that I've read as well. I just really mm-hmm. love her writing. I find it so juicy and descriptive in the best way, almost musical in places, very poetic at times. Do you have the same experience? Are there moments where you're like, Lainey, less words, like come on? Or is it a more Never. Even experience? No.
Never in terms of the language. Some like I said with the third book, sometimes there's some like plot things where I'm just like, okay, Lainey, you just could have stopped. You just could have not, we could have not done that. But like she does what I call synesthetic adjectives. And one of my favorite lines is from Razgut when it says she tastes like fairy tales, because that is such an unexpected but immediately evocative combination of words. And I think that that is something that Lainey Taylor is just amazing. Like, I would like to crawl into that part of her brain and just like hang out in there for a little while. And like you said, Maddie, I think it's, if that is a style for you, if you are here for things that are slightly more flowery and verbose and less plot cohesive, like this is not a Hemingway. This is not what you will be getting. But I think if you can vibe with that, then it's that that makes me stick through these books, even like as Nicole's going through her 1 minute summaries and I'm listening and being like, these books sound insane. Like these books are bonkers. The plots of these books are so wild. And it's the language that immediately gets you in and you're like, I don't even care. I will literally follow you to any world you're going to go to. And there are going to be a right. couple of them. And like, I will go with you to them.
I'm not a person that like visualizes a lot when I read, but her writing is so evocative, so full of color, of like smells and sights and tastes. And I feel like I can picture so many things so well. For good or for bad, like the pit where they put the chimera bodies, like the you know, Loramendi, the sort of structure that is, like Karu's blue hair, Prague. I've never been there. I feel like I have it in my head. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's so many things that she just brings so beautifully to life in a way that you read it and you're like, this is flowery and it's very descriptive, but it never feels like super heavy to me or like yes. it's trying too hard. Like mm-hmm. she, you know, you really almost have to pay attention. And I was trying to pay attention to see like what are the things she does, like what are the devices. And the thing is that she really mixes it up. There are times where it's just like you know, using a bunch of descriptors for one moment or one thing. There are times where she's just using like a repeated sound or, you know, mm-hmm. really short sentences to really get you into a rhythm. So it's so all over the place and so varied. She just brings all of her tricks and she's like, here's everything I got. I mean, maybe she has more, impressive, but she just really leaves it all on the table. Especially in the first book, I was like struck by the length of the chapters and how beautifully it flowed one into the other. Even the chapter titles at times, I was like, ha, funny. You know, so it's just all of it. The whole package, I think, is just so beautifully written.
I also agree that like the musicality is part of what is so fantastic about her writing. It's interesting because a common sort of stumbling block for me in fantasy is stuff that is overly descriptive, but I like this is never that. Like that's all mostly what I wanted to say is, as we're talking about like the places where she does do a ton of description, all of the description that she does always feels useful. Like when she is describing things, I never feel like I have gotten superfluous information. All of the information feels extremely relevant to what is going on there. And I think to Chelsea's earlier point, the only times where you could argue that we are getting superfluous, it's superfluous stuff, it's not actually the information, it's plot, it's structural, it's like it's bigger sort of things where it's like, okay, I don't know that you needed to try to tell this much story in this space. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in the ways that she is choosing to tell that much story in that space, it's never like it's the beats of that story never feel over explained.
It feels like she basically kind of started to set up for a future trilogy or future book or future kind of thing. Like, she was laying that future work. But like you were saying, as you're reading, it's not like in the moment you're like, well, wait now, why are we, how is this, what's going on here? Like, she takes you through that process very seamlessly.
Yes.
I think part of the reason that this descriptive fantasy works for me where some other descriptive fantasy doesn't work for me, it's because it is truly descriptive in a way that, like I said, it's like describing the things and the places and not like just listing things for the heck of like listing things. Like, the best comparison I have is, like, you know, the market that Karu goes to in the first book. I can visualize it. Like, I feel I have a sense of what that is. In George R.R. Martin's, like, A Game of Thrones, there's one, I don't even remember what book, they all bleed together for me, but Arya goes to a market, and I swear the description was like, there was an orange over there, and a thing over here, and a thing over here, and a thing, and I'm like, oh my god, if you don't stop listing the things that are at this market, I'm gonna lose it. So it's not, those are not descriptions, they're just literally words on a page, just listing things out, and it never feels like that to me with Taylor's writing. Like, I feel like she's adding things and bringing them to life versus just giving us random history of this offshoot of the, you know, the angels or this random story that has nothing to do with the main plot. It's just everything feels like it fits.
And I think for me it helps that, like, we start the story in Prague and, like, we start the story in known reality, and she carries the same kind of description style and the same, like, weight of what she chooses to describe and when over into her fantasy world. And so it feels like those are described with the same amount of, like, knowledge and lived in-ness as the actual real world of Prague. And so for me, it helps to kind of, like, bridge that connection between the fantasy and the reality, even if the language and the descriptions kind of, like, in the past in fantasy novels, that has, like, muddled some of that for me. Like, I never felt overloaded with description unnecessarily.
Okay, before we go... I'm amazed because I could literally keep talking about this for like another 3 hours, but I want to get your feelings on the end of the trilogy and how we leave sort of the books. And we've kind of alluded to it before, like, this feels like it could keep going, or there was like some sort of spinoff that she was building towards but has not come as of yet. But did you feel like the end matched the series? Did you feel like there was resolution? Were you happy with this ending?
Yes, it stuck out to me a lot this time how much of, like, the last 30-ish percent of the last book is very hardcore about how much Karu and Akiva just want to fuck. And they just want time and space to bone because they're safe now. And nobody will let them. Wars keep happening and people need to be resurrected. And, like, all they want to do is get busy. And they can't. So, like, I did, because, like, that feels very true to me, right? Like, they've gone through all of this, past lives, new lives, saving one world, figuring out they have to save another one. All these two want to do is, like, make out and have sex. And so the fact that, like, at the end of the book, that's what they get to do, even amongst all the other craziness, I was just like, yes. Like, yes. This feels very, like, satisfying, mostly like, it just, yes, I fully support the ending, even though we didn't need to start the bridge to, like, a whole nother intergalactic war. Mm-hmm. That's, like, my one hang up. Or Lainey Taylor, just write those books. Like, just write the next books that you've already set up the world for writing. They're right there.
It's sort of bittersweet because I hate that for Karu and Akiva. I wish they had a tidier ending where it felt a little bit more like, and they earned rest. And you're like, ah, yes, you know. But also, like, with the thematic content of this, like, the fact that it's like, I don't know, man, work keeps happening. I'm like, also true. Like, that. Yes. I understand that, like, sort of open-endedness to it, but at least she gave us resolution to what we were following and to their relationship. Like, in my head, it's open in the way that things keep happening to these two characters, but it's not open in a way that I'm like, oh, are they like together? Are they okay? I know they are. Yeah. Whatever war they're fighting, like, I feel like they're together in my heart. So it's a little bittersweet to me, sort of the openness of the ending. And yes, this is another trope that she, like, introduces. Usually when there's, like, two characters trying to bone at the end of the world, I'm like, focus. But here, it's been building for so long, and also the whole thing of this war and how they're bringing people together, it all started because they fell in love. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're like, that keeps pulling them along too, where they're just like, one day we'll get a boring life, like, let's keep going. And it's like constantly at the forefront. It feels right to me also, like, that we're reminded of that, of their love. That they want a bone. Like, that's fine. Right. I understand.
Also, like, props to Lainey Taylor, because she comes up with like 8,000 ways to express how much they want to bone without ever actually being crude enough to be like, and they just wanted to have sex and nobody would let them.
Yes. The peace, the dream of peace only begins because they met each other on a battlefield and were like, yeah, okay, I'd hit that. And it carries them through. So yes, 100% fitting and appropriate that's their big underlying motivator throughout the third book. I completely agree that the series is so heavy that while I would not have quibbled with a happy ending for these people, it feels a little bit wrong, and kind of much the same way that, you know, the Hunger Games trilogy, like that, the fact that they're, it's a series about people go like living through wars, right? Mm-hmm. And I just, the idea that it ends with, and then the war was over and everything was all better. Like, that's just not really, you know? As much as I struggled to explain the plot of the third book while reading it, I did not feel quite that sense of, why the fuck are you setting up this whole other series? Like, it didn't feel distracting to me in the way that it does when I try to think about explaining the plot. Like, I don't know. It flowed well enough in the context of the book. I want her to write it is the other thing.
Yeah.
Like, okay, just, you introduced this story, so what the fuck happens? And especially because of the ways that, like, the Strange the Dreamer and Muse of Nightmares sort of like wink and nod at this, you know, the Lainey Taylor multiverse. I'm ready for the rest of it.
Guys, okay? I'm like tin hatting right now. All I want is like Brandon Sanderson, but better and shorter. And I want Lainey Taylor to do it. And I want it to be all of these things that she is like writing. So I hope like I'm secretly fingers crossed that like that's something in a couple years she'll be like, and guess what? Now we've got the follow up. That was very well seated and crafted at the end of Daughters of the Bone.
I mean, I'm ready for it to be something else too. I would be okay if that thing were something more along the lines of Strange the Dreamer and Muse of Nightmares, where it's like, this is another sort of subset because like that it also sort of tracks. Mm-hmm. But I'm only okay with that if we're building towards all of these people coming together to fight those monster things, because those seem like the worst thing.
Give me the crossover event.
Those are the worst thing.
The end game event of Lainey Taylor's multiverse. Yes. Like, let's do it.
Give it to, there's literal portals. It wouldn't even be that hard. Come on, Lainey. Just come through.
I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
My actual favorite thing about the end of this book is not that Karu and Akiva spend like most of it thinking about how bad they want a bone, but that by the end of it, everybody else is like, get them a house, like fly them over, set it up. Do you need a kettle? Do you need a blanket?
And it's not even like the sexual energy. It's literally like, you two fuckers are so sad that if you don't just have sex and stop making the rest of us so knowing of your sadness, we're all going to go nuts.
The rest of us are trying to be happy because the war is over or whatever. And like, you guys and your down energy, we need to just like get you on Akiva's little island
and shut the hell up.
Yeah,
please. Like,
guys, we got you a whole winter together and a fuck house. Please just go be happy and leave the rest of us to like get shit done. I love the way that they all basically like offered gifts. Like it's a cute, it's almost like it's a little like domestic housewarming scene kind of in the midst of like knowing. It would be unrealistic to expect the Hunger Games kind of ending to this, but I do like what it says about finding those moments even in the midst of all the shit that's still continuing to happen around you. Like, that stuff doesn't stop, but you can still find time to bone in your newly gifted sex house.
Like, the other thing that was super cute about the end too, just like while we're here, okay, but I loved, so you know, Akiva is understanding his magic now or whatever, and he now has this ability to send like thoughts and emotions and experiences or whatever like through telepathy, and there's this bit where he's like, I really hope that I'm actually sending I miss you and I want a bone energy just to Karoo, and I'm not like sprinkling it like confetti over all the land between
broadcasting it on the radio waves.
That would be my great anxiety. It's like the reply all, like accidentally hitting reply all, but with magic.
I mean, and I feel like there's a good chance that he was replying all, which is why they decorated him a fuck house. They were like, oh my God.
If he had spent the last 6 months with every day, everybody getting the reply all of like, dear Karoo, love you, miss you, still want a bone, I would also be like, oh my God, please just find these two people somewhere to go.
And they have a perfectly good reason on why they don't need a resurrectionist for like a season, but I can just imagine like the council getting together and be like, can we just put this off and let Karoo go? Can we just let her go, please?
I got massive, like, we have clearly just cleared your calendar and we have made it okay for you to just go be here.
Okay, but also, now that you said that, I have another sort of, like, question, a thing that I don't feel is actually sort of sufficiently, I don't know, explained, I guess, at the end. But, like, now that they are in peacetime and that they have found this whole other, like, class of people with a strong affinity for magic, why the fuck is Karoo still the only resurrectionist? Like, what... The whole thing is, yes, she had an affinity for magic, and like that's part of how she took, like how she, you know, learned from Brimstone or whatever. But like, does she have an apprentice? Like, what I want to know is, where is Karoo's apprentice?
That's like the first thing I would be doing is being setting up like essential oils, like young life living. Like, okay, we're all going to meet on a Tuesday, and we're going to start with like what it is, and then we're going to start with teeth, and then, like we're going to get you trained.
Yeah, Karoo's boss babe. Business of resurrection. She's like currently emailing everyone she ever knows like, hey girl, how you doing? Are you interested?
You know how hard it is to get a boss bitch to take a vacation. No wonder they had to like clear her whole schedule to get her. Mm-hmm.
Listen, she's self-employed, okay? The self-employed can't take vacations.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you to Chelsea for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. If you are enjoying this podcast, consider sharing it with your friends. We'd also love to hear all of your thoughts on the Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can sign up to join our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. You can also find us on Twitter at @snark_squad. You can find me at My Name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
And I am at An Outlaw Life.
This podcast is produced by the Snark Squad. It is edited by Nicole Sweeney and transcribed by me. The theme music that is playing us out right now is by Stephen Chin.